Developing Northern Australia as a food bowl for Asia is a stretch too far and overlooks better opportunities in sectors like health, education and defence. That's the view of Professor Andrew Campbell, the Director of Institute for Environment and Livelihood at Charles Darwin University. He says there are too many constraints on expanding agriculture by more than 5%. Professor Campbell told Serena Locke that knowing how to develop tropical agriculture could be exported to Asia rather than the actual produce.
What are the big constraints?
Well, it's a very fierce climate. If you ask any farmer whether they'd like to go and farm somewhere where there's guaranteed drought every year, where evaporation is markedly greater than rainfall, so people think of the north as being having water abundance. In fact, it has water scarcity. And there are many novel pests and diseases that are difficult to handle. Input costs are much higher, labour's more difficult to attract, infrastructure's much poorer, and supply chains are much more vulnerable.
But can't they be overcome with modern technology and road building?
Technology can improve your ability to handle some of those issues. Some are more fundamental, and the overall framework of governance, property rights, infrastructure are difficult for an individual producer to control, so they need to be tackled at a system level. And to be fair, the white paper on developing Northern Australia lays that challenge out in a realistic way.
Yes, I mean, a lot of the focus has been on Northern Australia's ability to be a food bowl, which you criticise, and you say it's in those other areas. So explore those a bit more.
Again, the white paper is clear that tropical health, international education, defence industries, tourism, resources and energy are all, they're the planks of northern development. It's not just about agriculture or food. And I think that's a realistic framework. And we need to be thinking across that full spectrum, not just about the food thing, which at the end of the day will be quite modest.
David Williams, the investment banker, is scathing about big-scale failures among the Ord, for example. What's your view on, the successes and failures in the Ord?
There's been an enormous investment, particularly of public funds, to date, and I haven't seen any independent economic benefit cost analysis of that. But the fact is the dam is there, the infrastructure is there, and so I think we should make the most of it, and it would be good to see those resources developed. I also think there is potential for us to think about more radical ideas, such as using that resource to produce energy as well as potentially food and fibre.
Give me an example of how you could produce energy from the sun up in the Northern Australia and the water that's there.
Well, northwestern Australia enjoys a lot more sun than, for example, Java, so we get more solar energy per square metre in a year. It's not as cloudy. And with colleagues, we've mapped out a scheme that would use, if you converted one cattle station to solar panels, say 250 square kilometres of panels, you could use that to pump water out of Lake Argyle up to a big turkey nest dam, quite a large one, and then have it flowing downhill overnight through turbines in a hydro scheme. That's called a pumped hydro scheme. And you could then produce power 24/7. And if you had a high voltage direct current cable like the one between Victoria and Tasmania or between Norway and the Netherlands or the one proposed from Iceland to Scotland, you could run that, say, Kununurra, Katherine, Darwin, Dili, Denpasar, Jakarta, Singapore and wherever, up into ASEAN countries.
But wouldn't that be hideously expensive?
It would be. The projections done by Andrew Blakers at ANU suggest that the cost in Jakarta would be about 8 cents a kilowatt hour. They currently spend 6 cents a kilowatt hour on coal-fired power. So, and this would produce in perpetuity with zero emissions and would avoid building very expensive power stations in areas that are prone to earthquakes, tsunamis and volcanic eruptions. So there are many advantages. All of the engineering is very straightforward. It's all off the shelf. The geopolitical and the financial engineering, however, is not straightforward.
Yes, I mean, you've proposed this to Indonesians, a delegation. How did that go?
They'd already thought of the idea. We were gobsmacked to find that Indonesian energy planners had thought about this 20 years ago and had identified that as their most sustainable long-term potential power supply. Malcolm Eccles, the CEO of Basslink, said to us, look, physically, the engineering's very straightforward. It's your financial engineering that will be complicated. So getting the investment together, it would cost somewhere around $850 billion. Indonesia's planning to spend about $1 trillion on power over between now and 2030. So it's of the same order of magnitude. The question is whether you could get the right architecture in place politically and financially to make it feasible. But engineering-wise, straightforward.
Short of the solar farm being developed, there is an industry of tourism that's there. So how does it rank and could it be developed?
I think so. If you think about the area from Broome around to Cairns, it's the world's largest region of unregulated rivers. There's only one dam in that area, the Lake Argyle. So you've got this amazing... We did a recent survey of the Daly River, found more than 100 fish species without a single alien fish. It's hard to imagine where you could go in the world where you could survey an entire river system and not find an introduced species. So the north is still an amazing place. And if we got the story right on cultural tourism, ecotourism, adventure tourism, like the Kiwis are doing extremely well, as well as your grey nomad market and the backpacker market and then the cruise boats coming in, I think there's a lot of legs yet in a really value-added tourism experience across northern Australia that would be, shall we say, less exposed to boom-bust cycles than some of the commodity markets, although it's still very sensitive to the price of the Australian dollar. But nevertheless, I think we got 20 years of turbocharging out of Crocodile Dundee, and in that time, possibly there wasn't sufficient investment in new product and really thinking about the tourism across northern Australia. But in my view, that's something that is ripe for development. But a bit like agriculture, it's constrained by having lots and lots of small enterprises that don't really have sufficient scale to put a whole vertically integrated system together. And so we're going to have to think cleverly about how we achieve the capital for that.
One of the things that you say is achievable is small-scale developments. Give me an example of that. Food, I mean.
The mango growers around Darwin, started by Vietnamese immigrants with virtually no capital, no extension, no research, no English. they did an amazing job when you think of what they achieved in the circumstances they did it. A couple of key ingredients. They had direct contact with their customers in the markets of Sydney and Melbourne, who are often their relatives, and they financed the development, so the customer was paying for the development. They worked really, really hard. They shared a lot of knowledge amongst themselves, and they've built somewhere close to a $100 million industry with very little assistance, but they grew organically. It wasn't a massive, big external investment coming in. So as Ian Baker, who's a consultant to the food sector in the north, says, we often start big and grow small if you look at agricultural development in the north. And the mango growers are a great example of how you can start small and grow organically at a natural pace. And that's, to me, a terrific success story.
But smaller scale and very fledgling would be other more indigenous foods?
Potentially. I think there's some very exciting things on the horizon. It's trite to say it because these species have been around for millennia, so they're not new to the indigenous people, but Kakadu plum has more vitamin C than any other plant known to humans, and it's been used for medicinal purposes by indigenous people for millennia. It would be possible to think about a supply chain that rewarded particularly groups of Indigenous women on country for doing the collecting and then put it through some sort of co-op arrangement. And then some of the high-value, niche-branded health food companies could be marketing that as an exclusive product around the world. There are native rices on the floodplains of the north, Indigenous wild rices, that again have been used by Indigenous people for millennia. they have extraordinary genetic diversity, and in the hands of some of our world-class agri technicians in Quaffey and other places, there's the potential for them to be introduced into breeding programs with some of the mainstream rices to improve their resilience in a changing climate and so on. So there are some bright spots on the agronomy side of things. I think there's enormous potential in northern aquaculture, particularly using the new Syro-developed land-based feedstock for example, prawn farming. There's still a lot of legs in carbon farming for Indigenous people using fire management, as we're seeing with the Walfa and Kalfa projects. The Indigenous Ranger programs give us a wonderful backbone of employment structure and training and so on to build from in an environmental services industry. And Darwin's now has a huge defence footprint, and with the Marines coming as well, defence service industries are a bright spot. And with all of that, there's still considerable scope to grow international education in Darwin and Townsville and Cairns, with people from the tropics coming to a warm place rather than to Canberra or Melbourne or Sydney, much as they're lovely cities. Climatically, they're a bit difficult for colleagues from the north. So if you put all those things together, potentially the outlook for the north is bright. But if you just put all your eggs in the food basket, then I think you're likely to continue this boom-bust cycle, which hasn't been very sustainable to date.
Professor Andrew Campbell from Charles Darwin University speaking with Serena Locke. You're with RN, I'm Brett Worthington. Australian farmers are not alone in their battle for seasonal workers. In the United States, farmers say delays in receiving foreign worker approvals means up to a quarter of some crops are dying in paddocks unharvested. Much like in Australia, the issue requires a political fix that appears unlikely to change anytime soon.
Mexico is taking business away from us, folks, like you wouldn't believe. What are we going to do with Mexico? We're going to build a wall.
It's comments like these from Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump that are frustrating farmers. They want an overhaul of foreign farm worker visas, but as debate about immigration, Mexicans, and a great southern wall rage ahead of November's election, their campaign has all but fallen off the political radar.
Locally, you know, I spoke with a lot of growers in our area, and they estimate 23 to 27% loss of crops.
Carlos Costanera is a farm labour contractor supplying Californian farmers with workers to pick leafy green and berry crops. He says the reason a quarter of some Californian crops are dying is because farmers simply cannot get enough workers for the harvest.
I've never seen a local come in. So, in other words, this work has always been done by immigrant labour.
Why is that, do you think?
There's a pretty big stigma, at least for me, you know, my experience going to school. It's like, oh boy, oh, you're a farmer, oh, your dad's a farmer. You'd rather be working at McDonald's, just to say the least.
It's not just that we have a low workforce, but we have a low number of people that are willing to do the work on a farm and ranch.
Katie Hager and her husband Stephen are third-generation farmers in North Dakota.
And we grow primarily corn, soybeans, and hard red spring wheat.
In 14 years of job ads, the Hagers have had just 6 applications from US citizens applying to work on their farm. None eventuated into actual work, which is why the Hagers use temporary labourers from South Africa through the H-2A visa program. It allows workers to come into the US to work on farms where the owners have shown they're unable to hire local workers.
Our unemployment rate in the state of North Dakota fluctuates between 2% and 4%. That was at that rate before we had a big energy boom. We have oil in the state of North Dakota, and so we had that small unemployment rate even more depleted when that energy boom hit. And so because we are lacking a workforce, we are reliant upon the H-2A visa program to get seasonal farm workers.
Record numbers of farmers applied to hire workers through the H-2A program last year, with applications up a further 13% this year. Bureaucratic delays means processing these applications is taking longer, and workers are arriving late, if at all, leaving farmers workerless with crops dying in the ground. Christy Boswell is with the lobby group, the American Farm Bureau.
The only way agriculture will have access to a legal and stable workforce in America is through legislative reform, Congress taking action, addressing immigration reform, creating an adjustment of status for our experienced agricultural workers who are here working valuable to our farms but are in unauthorized status, and then the creation of a new guest worker program that would replace this cumbersome H-2A program and have a program that's much more market-based, flexible, and efficient for both the farmer and the worker.
The Farm Bureau estimates between 50 to 75% of farm labourers are unauthorised workers in the US. With politicians vowing to deport any unauthorised Mexicans, farmers are at further risk of a shrinking workforce.
Farmers in America want to, as farmers in Australia, you know, want to provide an affordable, safe, local product. We want to grow it here, and labor is the biggest hindrance right now for a lot of these farmers who don't know if they can continue to plant those, you know, fruits and vegetables. And dairy is a huge issue here as well, and relying on an immigrant workforce and whether those workers are going to be available to milk the cows. So we do need Congress to act, and we need responsible immigration reform, and not that politics hijack a very broken immigration system here in America.
The farm lobby says offering to pay above the minimum wage has done little to lure US citizens into farm work. So if locals won't work on farms and politicians refuse to reform visas to make it easier to recruit foreign labour willing to do the work, the situation facing farmers is unlikely to change anytime soon. Christy Boswell says her greatest frustration is that there's little farmers can do because this is a political issue that requires a political solution.
There's a lot of sympathies on Capitol Hill, but we are lumped into this really broad, complex immigration debate because of the nature of our workforce. And so while a lot of members of Congress and senators understand and want to help and do what they can to help, whether it be signing letters or introducing legislation, whether there's a true window for that to move through Congress, I don't think that will happen in 2016.
North Carolina farmer Katie Hager. A photo of the Hager family and more on that story is online right now. Just do a search for A Country Breakfast, RN. And that's it for this week. Thanks to Kerry Dell for technical production. The news is up next on RN. I'm Brett Worthington. Thanks for listening.